This is Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main. It's the Daily Buzz on KCPW, back for a fourth year, shockingly enough, back for a fourth year of the Daily Buzz, produced by the Film Society of Lincoln Center and our producer, seated to my right, Irene Cho. I can't believe it's been 4 years.
I know. I don't know where the time flew, Eugene.
I don't know where it went. Really excited to be back with the Daily Buzz. And this year, we're supported by our sponsor, Soyombo Vodka. Thrilled to have them on board for this daily program on KCPW each evening. Thrilled to be back here in Park City on KCPW. On today's show, in just a few moments, we'll have our Hot Topics Roundtable. We start each show with a roundtable of journalists and industry insiders. So my colleague Brian Brooks from the Film Society will be co-hosting that segment. He'll be here in a moment, along with John Wildman from the Film Society and Eric Cohn, the lead critic over at IndieWire. Later in the show, Brian Knappenberger, director of Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz, he'll be here to talk about that new documentary, as will Todd Miller, and he directed a documentary called Dinosaur 13 about the search for T-Rexes, and his film is one of the opening night films at this year's festival. Later in the show, Ryan Werner from Cinetic and Ariana Bacco will be here to talk about the sort of industry side of the festival. I thought it'd be, just for a moment, I thought it'd be valuable to kind of tease some of the other guests that we've got coming up. Number of notable actors, and Irene, jump in if there's anybody I forget. Anne Hathaway will be here later in the week. Catherine Keener,
Alfred Molina,
John Lithgow, they're in the same film, Love is Strange.
Kurt Russell.
George Takei will be here later in the week. Excited about that. Among the filmmakers, we've got Greg Araki will be here. He has a new film called White Bird in a Blizzard. Joe Berlinger, Steve James made a documentary about Roger Ebert.
Yeah, and we're talking to Christopher Nolan and the founders of Slamdance because it's their 20th anniversary.
All right, so we've got quite a week set up for the Daily Buzz. And as we kick off this first day at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, our show starts always with our Hot Topics segment. Excited to have seated with me here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main our co-host for Hot Topics, Brian Brooks from the Film Society of Lincoln
Hello.
Center. My colleague, as well from Lincoln Center, from the Film Society, Mr. John Wildman.
Always cool to be back.
The Wild Man, who's here as a journalist. You're writing for Film Threat.
Film Threat and Film Comment.
And you have a Film Comment as well, and you have a regular column on Film Threat.
Yeah, Film's Gone Wild.
Film's Gone Wild. Perfect. John Wildman. And seated across from me, wearing his signature striped hoodie, Mr. Eric Cohn, the senior editor of IndieWire and also the film critic for IndieWire.
I wear a lot of hats and my Hamburglar outfit. Very happy to be back.
This feels very, it's a nice way to start the festival for me because everybody at this table, we've worked together for a number of years and been friends for a number of years as well. So off to a good start at Sundance. So let me ask you guys, I really want to let you guys kind of lead this Hot Topics in the 12 or 13 minutes we have. Let me start with Eric, seated right across from me. Sundance 2014, give our listeners a sense of what you're thinking about going into this year's festival as a way of starting our conversation, and then you guys jump in. But let's just sort of see what Eric's sort of thinking about coming into Sundance this year.
Well, I think like a lot of listeners, I didn't start my morning thinking about Sundance, but thinking about the Oscars.
This morning, the Oscar nominations were announced.
It's bright and early at 6:30 a.m. here in Park City. I'm sure Redford was watching from wherever he's staying in his condo. And the snub of sorts for Redford for All Is Lost is, I think, one of the more interesting ways into talking about Sundance 2014, because it seemed like a dramatic snub. There's this great movie, All Is Lost, directed by J.C. Chandor. It's, a lot of people say, Redford's best performance in years, if not ever, and he didn't make it to the final cut. And yet, who cares about the Oscars? And I think that kind of prevailing narrative is the right way to think about a festival in which, as we look at this lineup, there isn't one popular favorite. The buzz machine isn't really propelling us to talk about a single film, but actually many different movies and a lot of question marks. And that's much more exciting. So to some degree, I think it's actually a good thing that this snub happened now, because it reminds us that there should be a narrative about sort of the alternative marketplace for independent film.
Now, I think throwing it out to the others at the table, I mean, Sundance obviously cares about the Oscars. How can you not? I mean, when you look at, I mean, films like Cutie and the Boxer, Dirty Wars got nominated for documentary this morning. Mm-hmm.
The Square also, which had its initial cut last year.
Yeah. Festival like Sundance certainly doesn't, they wouldn't complain about a Sundance film getting an Oscar nomination. I mean, John, you're a journalist and also a publicist. You've worked with a lot of festivals. Oscars, do they help or hurt the sort of expectations of the press and the audience coming to a festival? Does it sort of create too much attention, or does it create too much of a...
Well, no, you know, focus? I honestly think the films that come from Sundance, and that level of independent film, that makes it to even that just that awards dance, maybe not to the final round of Oscar. They are obviously few and far between for very good reasons. A lot of them economic, and a lot of them, a lot of these films fight hard to find their audiences. But I think that, Eric is a good point that, the people that, like myself, that are coming here are really excited about filmmakers we haven't met yet. And and people that we're going to become very familiar with in the next couple of years, but this is going to be our introduction to them, mm-hmm. as opposed to people we've seen frequently, mm-hmm. and people that are routinely in that Oscar hunt. Mm-hmm. That that's why you're excited to be here.
Yeah. I mean, last year, who knew the filmmakers behind Fruitvale Station, which of course did tremendous and had quite a lot of awards buzz throughout up until unfortunately today it
exactly.
didn't make the cut. But I mean. Fantastic run, great film, and last year its counterpart, Beasts of the Southern Wild, did get an Oscar nomination. Again, a filmmaker that few people knew and now has a career to a whole other level.
Right, and J.C. Chandor is another, mm-hmm. another good example.
Yeah, exactly.
And mm-hmm. it's thrilling, and we're thrilled to death when those guys and those women make it to that level. But again, the overwhelming community here, I we haven't met the people that I'm mm-hmm. going to be thrilled about.
Well, I also think that there needs to be another conversation going on that's not about these great, amazing discoveries and how far they can go, but the fact that they have to be discovered in order to exist as movies in this community at all. So I'm more excited about things that aren't really readily marketable, that aren't necessarily going to be tagged as the next, awards bait. Or anything like that, because the festival is really populated by them. And you look at the next section, which has mm-hmm. evolved so wonderfully and is now, without a doubt, the most popular part of Sundance for people who come here to see great movies. Films like Listen Up Philip or Land Ho, I think, are really going to be sort of interesting discoveries mm-hmm. that people are going to be talking about well beyond Sundance, just as great cinema.
And Appropriate Behavior also got some buzz.
Appropriate Behavior.
Also, Appropriate Behavior, sorry.
Yeah.
Or inappropriate.
we're in this kind of bubble where we know what all of these sort of terms and sections mean. But for those who are listening who maybe are getting an introduction to the festival, Eric, you talked about the next section. Can you sort of give us the 30-second sort of thumbnail kind of description of that section and sort of how it's evolved and what it is so that people maybe as they hear about this section over the course of the next few days as we talk about it on the show, get a sense of sort of what that section is and why it's become so popular?
Well, I think the festival is still kind of defining what the next section is, but they define it better than ever this year. And yet, last year it was really strong as well, but it was initially started as sort of a place for emerging voices, for sort of offbeat storytelling and low budget projects that, for one reason or another, largely I think some political reasons, don't make it into the main competition but still deserve a spot at a high profile festival like Sundance. Mm-hmm. It took a little while for the section to find its groove, but what I think it does is it just makes more room for more interesting movies, and that's basically a win for everybody involved.
And that budget number, also, to be blunt, is a key there. You have people that are making amazing films, but they're making them without having access to money to make those amazing films, and yet they're pulling it off, and yet they're doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that budget level cutoff you know, is a big key, and it's one of the reasons, again, why that's one of my favorite sections, and has since they created it, because I know, you know, those are the people that really had to make that movie. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that they weren't doing it for, you know, business reasons or because, you know, they were contractually obligated. No, they've been living and they needed to make that movie because that's the only way those movies got made.
And I would also add that I think what the next section's evolution points to, and there's no question it's evolved. The festival even created a spinoff called Next Weekend, which took place in LA over the summer. It sort of shows that there is a desire internally at the festival to kind of shake things up, to make things funkier, kinkier, weirder, even though there is a marketplace pressure to have the star-driven projects and more commercially viable projects. I mean, look at the Midnight section, always some really great, crazy stuff with an international component that comes out of that section for a very particular crowd. The director of programming at this festival, Trevor Groff, used to own that section. So the people running this festival really have a predilection for weirder, crazier stuff. And so you have to kind of look at the program in that context and realize that certain factors mandate what's in more prominent slots, but everybody's kind of trying to push the things out there that wouldn't get there organically.
The headline from this conversation so far is Sundance programmers have a predilection for weird stuff. Eric Cohn.
Use it.
That tweet that, make sure you hashtag Daily Buzz and make sure you tag Eric Cohn on Twitter.
Please.
So a lot of discoveries, but a finite amount of time in which to do it. How do you guys go about figuring out what to cover? I mean, obviously, can't do everything.
Well, you know, it's Eric beat me to the punch on the Midnight section, mm-hmm. which I'm a genre guy and always, you know, heading for that. And so I'm very excited to see Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett's next movie, Chase. I'm very excited to see that. The Raid sequel. The Raid was just, you know, mm-hmm. one of the just thrilling movies you know that I had. So I cannot wait for that sequel. You know, now Cooties could be, you know zombie youngsters. You know, that could be a fun movie, but I'm also a little bit nervous about it because mm-hmm. I was very excited about Grabbers last year going into it. And, you know, and it's disappointing. So that's one of those movies I'm going, I've got my fingers crossed. Please be what I'm hoping you're going to be. And then we were talking about a movie that mm-hmm. I've seen coming in here that's not in the Midnight section, but Wetlands, which I loved because talk about weird and talk about crazy. It may be the grossest movie you'll ever see, but so compelling and with an amazingly charismatic lead that you cannot stop watching that movie. You can't.
It's a gross movie, but it's a sweet movie, and mm-hmm. people should probably Google it and read the premise so we don't have to try to, you know, flub
right.
the description here.
I'll throw in a plug for a movie that I was able to watch before the festival called Dear White People, and I think it's definitely a film that people will be talking about once they see it. It's mm-hmm. a satire about sort of Ivy League college and the people of color who go to school there and are sort of at odds with a fraternity that throws a party in which all the frat guys dress up as black people. So they're playing with this topic in a really, they're taking a very serious topic and playing with it in a kind of satirical, kind of fun way. There's certainly an influence of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing at work.
I'm hearing echoes of School Days as well in that
yeah.
description.
Yeah, that, me too.
So I'm curious in the few minutes that we have, I liked what John said earlier about sort of the people he's most excited about are the ones he's yet to meet. And so maybe for our listeners who are kind of tuning in to get a sense of how to tackle this festival, it's a massive festival. You know, you have films with big stars, and often the films with the big stars that get all the buzz going into the festival aren't the ones we're going to be talking about later this week. Mm-hmm. Give us a few titles that each of you are excited about, and mm-hmm. films that you're going to be tracking, films mm-hmm. that you have hopes for, whether it be a film with a star or whether it be just a description that looks interesting or a film you might be hearing a little bit of buzz about. What are the films you're going to be tracking, and then we'll kind of follow along and see how you did later in the week and see whether those films kind of held mm-hmm. up to our scrutiny.
Again, Adam's film, The Guest, that one, Blue Ruin. I'm very excited.
I saw in Cannes, and honestly, not something that I would normally go for based on description, but I watched it and it's fantastic.
Everybody's telling me that one mm-hmm. is right up my alley. Mm-hmm. I cannot wait. Mm-hmm. The Double, actually, which we just recently announced is going to be in new directors, new films as well. Very stylistic movie. That one, Eric?
You know, I mean, it's interesting. The more you kind of live and breathe film festival culture, there aren't a whole lot of surprises in the traditional sense, but I think for people who are just kind of thumbing through the catalog, there will be plenty of them. You may not have heard of Aaron Katz, for example, but he's made some terrific movies like Cold Weather and Quiet City, which are worth checking out, and he's got an Icelandic road trip comedy co-directed by Martha Plimpton in the next section called Land Ho that just looks wonderful, and I've heard some early reactions have been quite strong. And I'm also actually looking forward to Camp X-Ray. It's a competition film with Kristen Stewart as a Guantanamo Bay guard, which at this point, post-Twilight, sounds campy and silly, but that's only because at this point, people have forgotten that she used to be a pretty serious indie actress, and this movie from a first-time filmmaker looks quite promising to me.
I mean, one thing I'm curious to see is The Case Against Eight, which is a documentary about the battle for same-sex marriage, particularly in California. But one thing I think, obviously, being here in Utah and the headlines that are happening here right now with the sort of the is it going to happen, is it not going to happen, sort of the limbo that it's in, I think
gay
it
marriage.
Could be, yeah, for gay marriage here in Utah, which I was quite surprised by when I first read about it at home in New York. But nevertheless, I think it's going to be quite an interesting screening just to see that, just to see how the reaction will be.
That'll be on Saturday at noon, yeah. I think.
And if I could just plug one documentary so it doesn't sound like I only watch made-up stories all the time, there's an incredible movie in the World Documentary Competition. It's called Concerning Violence. It's about African colonialism. It's set to text read by Lauryn Hill that was written in the 1960s. It's one of the more incredible documentaries I've seen in a really long time.
Brian Brooks, our co-host for Hot Topics, Eric Cohn from IndieWire, John Wildman, who's filing for Film Threat and Film Comment. Thank you guys for being here this morning as we kick off this first edition of The Daily Buzz at the Sundance Film Festival. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Wrapping up this first edition of the Daily Buzz at the Sundance Film Festival 2014. This is Eugene Hernandez at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main. Sitting with Ryan Werner from Cinetic Media and Ariana Bacco from IFC Films. Welcome.
Hello.
I thought it would be interesting as we wrap up this first show, and in our final segment of each show, it's called the sort of Industry Insider segment. We used to call it the industry veteran segment, but people didn't like being called veterans.
Thank you, Eugene.
How many Sundances have you attended, Ariana?
This is my 19th Sundance.
So we're not going to call you a veteran, but you're definitely seasoned at
yes,
Sundance. Ryan, how many seasoned. For you?
It's my 15th.
Well, so let's see, 19 plus 15.
How is that possible? I'm younger than you.
You are?
I'm just kidding.
19 plus 15, this is my 21st. So collectively between the three of us, we're like...
We're very seasoned.
We're not veterans, but we're well seasoned. I thought it would be interesting to start, and you two used to work together at IFC Films.
Yes, for 7 years.
Long time.
Yeah.
So you would come into a festival like this when you worked together, and you would map out sort of a strategy for buying films. And at the time that you guys worked together, IFC had launched a VOD day and date strategy. So you were acquiring a lot of films, and you still are acquiring a lot of films, mm-hmm. but you were acquiring a lot of films out of Sundance and working together to do that. I want to start by looking at a topic that's come up a lot in the days leading up to Sundance. Manola Dargis had an article in the New York Times recently. Kind of her message to the industry was, stop buying so many movies. There's too many movies that are kind of flooding the marketplace. I want to hear sort of what the two of you think, because there's been sort of a debate and a discussion going on online about that idea and whether there are too many movies or and what role sort of a festival like Sundance plays in that reality, if you agree that it's true, or maybe you don't. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, there are quite a lot of movies. I think that's a fact, and I don't think that's anything that's disputed. But whether or not that is good or bad is, I think, what the conversation is. And right. And I think what the article missed really is a larger conversation about, it's not just that it's too many movies, it's how are audiences watching films? You know, mm-hmm. how are they, being consumers of content? And I think there are so many, the point really now is there are so many different ways that audiences are watching films, and it, as a distributor, it's our responsibility to try to reach those audiences to see, you know, where they can watch these movies. And sorry, there's strange things being put in my but anyway, I think that the point really is that it's our responsibility to curate. And I think curation is going to be really the thing. And what Sundance Film Festival does is to, you know, it curates for us and it presents these films for us to acquire. And there's never too many good films. I mean, there really is never too many good films. And, and it's the critics' responsibility to curate as well and to review them. And, you know, who are we to stop a filmmaker from making a movie, you know?
I agree with you, and I think it's interesting. It does seem, I was talking to a critic the other day, and it seems like Manola's article is almost like a cry for help. It's sort of, and I want to bring Ryan into the conversation, because Ryan, as someone who works closely with journalists, with critics, on the marketing and PR side, as you're developing a release strategy for a film on the distribution side, it seems like a particular moment in which critics are really feeling overwhelmed, and yet when you see a good movie, if you see a bunch of good movies at a festival, you rarely say there's too many of them, right?
So of course.
If anything else, you're looking for more good movies. I don't know. What's your take on this, I guess?
Well, I think there's too many movies coming out in terms of like getting people's attention. I think it's really good though for all the films that get theatrical releases, because it helps build a profile for the other platforms and to show people that these movies are out there. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of getting people's attention, there's only a couple of films a week that can do that. And the rest of the films just kind of get lost. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, at IFC, they have the good fortune of working on so many good movies that often they'll get a lot of attention from the press and the critics. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other movies that might not have the same kind of team behind them or the profile, and I think those films end up suffering. Mm-hmm. When 30 films open a week, which often happens in New York and LA, it doesn't benefit anybody.
Except I think that there are films that, you know, you have to, when you go out to distribute a film, or when a film, you know, is beginning its journey to reach audiences, I think you have to create what the expectations are. And some of the films just aren't going to ever be theatrical or ever get that theatrical attention. I don't think that's any different from, you know, how it was 20, 25 years ago. I think that's always going to be the case, that some films will fare better on other platforms.
Yeah, I think the key for filmmakers at Sundance is to really, like, in terms of, like, having their film acquired and released, is to think about who their audience is and, like, what the best way to reach them. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the best way for success. Because a lot of films that don't have huge box office might actually find an audience on, like, iTunes or on demand. And the trick is figuring out how to target the marketing and publicity towards those films.
Right.
I mean, to those audiences.
Right.
Picking up on something that you were saying a minute ago, Ariana, and that is the notion of curation, and I agree with you. Coming from the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and we produce festivals year-round, curation is really kind of, if we were to define our organization in one word, it's curation, right? Mm-hmm. So I agree with you on that point. At the same time, I'm wondering how, put aside the films that get acquired, Ryan, you're speaking to films by independent filmmakers and sort of how they develop a strategy for coming into a festival like this. It can feel kind of overwhelming to look at a festival like this. And look, most of the films that play at Sundance will get some kind of a release. You look at last year's catalog, and certainly films in competition and Next, they got a release in some fashion. But if the critics are overwhelmed and distributors have a finite number of films that they can acquire, how does a filmmaker sort of orient themselves for coming into a festival like this? And how does an audience, because the audiences are going to read about and hear about on radio shows and TV broadcasts, all of these films, some of which they may never get a chance to see or may not see in the sort of environment than they might have expected.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort of advise sort of filmmakers on the one hand and audiences on the other to sort of process what they're seeing over the next 10 days, what they're hearing about over the next 10 days?
That's a big question. I mean, in terms of filmmakers, I think that you need to surround yourself with a really good team of advisors mm-hmm. to set your expectations, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of going in of what your film is and, mm-hmm. you know, how do you anticipate it might play and mm-hmm. who, as Ryan was saying, you know, who are the audiences that you can target in terms of your marketing and publicity. So I think that, you know, going in, it's really about expectations, but you're unveiling it for the first time. So you also, you're going to get a very good barometer of what the audience, how the audiences are reacting mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. it, so that you can further strategize about how, mm-hmm. what's the next step, because it's really just the next step. I mean, once you make a film, releasing it and premiering it, it's a whole other, you know, ball of wax.
What I hear you saying is Sundance is not the end. It's it's the starting point. It's a way to get the sense of an audience, of an industry, and don't look at what happens here as the end all be all film. You're going to go in a totally different direction.
Yeah, I think, absolutely. I think, like, you know, there's certain films that rise to the top here, like Beasts of the Southern Wild or something like that. And then there's other films that will premiere here, get a good response, maybe a little bit of press, but they'll go on to other festivals. And sometimes it takes another screening, another location. Like, there's been films that have screened here and then gone to South By and, like, really stood out. So I think it's kind of about, it's a longer term process. And it's also, I think what Ariana said, working with a team of publicists and sales agents that can really advise you, because you know, there's so many films in Sundance that it's not all of them are going to be able to like, you know, be the next Beast of the Southern Wild. But I think, like, a lot of them end up finding, like, good homes in the end.
Let's switch gears in the 5 minutes we have left. Let's talk about some of the films. Let's talk about this year's festival. You're obviously not going to tell me, Ariana, the films that you're hoping to buy. So we will put that aside, obviously. But let's talk about some of the films that are at least intriguing to you, either because of their pedigree. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a number of films by filmmakers who've been in this festival before, mm-hmm. or who have a track record. And there's certainly any number of films that we can sort of look online and watch the trailer or read in the catalog some of the descriptions. Ryan, you have the catalog open in front of you. I'll start with you. What are some of the films that you're intrigued by, curious about, anxious for, just on a personal level? What are films that you're excited about?
Well, I mean, the one thing is, like, at Sundance, it's the one festival, like, where I usually like to come and I don't really prepare. Like, mm-hmm. I look through the catalog and have a sense. I don't have to do what Ariana does, which is, like, buy the movies.
Ariana's going to say the opposite. She has to prepare, and her team has to prepare.
So for me, I'll just stumble into them. I mean, the documentaries are, like, a priority. There's always so many great documentaries here. So I don't have the same kind of, like, plan that Ariana does. But there, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers here that have made movies that I'm obviously looking forward to.
I think the beauty of Sundance is, like, Ryan and I worked together last year on Dirty Wars, which just got an Oscar nomination today. And so, you know, it's very nice to be here with Ryan. But I think, you stumble into films as well that you didn't necessarily put on your priority list, mm-hmm. because you don't know. And that's the beauty of Sundance, is discovery. Mm-hmm. So I'm super excited to see a lot of the filmmakers we've worked with in the past, their new films, like Aaron Katz and David Zellner and Michael Tully and Joe Swanberg and Lynn Shelton. I mean, we've really worked with a lot of these filmmakers in their early films. And so I'm always excited to see their new films. And then also just really discovering new films. Mm-hmm. I think for me personally, that is what keeps me going, and hopefully to a 20th Sundance, you know, next year, is right. You really have to feel passionate and get these films that you discover, but also get excited for filmmakers who are continuing their careers.
I think it's interesting. There's four films by Iranian American filmmakers this year too, and they all sound very intriguing. So I'll be curious about those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
curious to know. In the sort of 2 minutes we have left, it's interesting to see some of the range of Sundance, or to see this at the range of Sundance, and how, you know, this festival has historically been defined as a marketplace or a starting point for American independent cinema. And if you look at the sort of the range of the program, more than 100 features, it's a probably more diverse range of work than I've ever seen at this festival. Ryan mentions films from Iran. Mm-hmm. It seems like this festival has really sort of responded to independent filmmaking that's happening sort of around the world, even though it's still anchored around this American competition.
Right.
Can either of you sort of speak to sort of the international component? I see a lot more international buyers coming, right. International press. Give us a sense of that.
I mean, it's like the American version of Cannes. I mean, it's like where the big films come that premiere around the world. I mean, I think one of the favorite films probably Ariana and I both worked on together was In the Loop, which mm-hmm. premiered here. Didn't have a huge profile. Like, I mean, we
not
spent a lot of time building it, and then it ended up getting an Oscar nomination, like, also. So, I mean, I think that's, like, a great example of international film.
I think there tends to be a lot of focus on the American indies at Sundance, and Ryan's right, there are a lot of international films, and I've seen it progressing more and more, and that might be in terms of the changing of the guard at Sundance in terms of the curation. But I think it's really exciting because I think that we are a world marketplace, and I think it's really important to continue that and to focus new filmmakers coming into that world marketplace from other parts of the world other than the U.S. And I think the fact that international buyers are coming here to pick up worldwide rights is a testament to the quality of the films, because, you know, these are films that have to work on a business level throughout the whole world. So I think that's really great. It's great for filmmakers. It's great. It's really good for everybody.
Well, collectively, the two of you and your teams will probably see just about every film, every feature that's playing here at the festival, I would imagine, or just about every film.
Hopefully, that's the goal.
So we'll let you get to it. Ryan Werner and Arianna Bacco, thanks for being on The Daily Buzz.
Thank you, Eugene.
See you soon.
Bye.
Continuing on this opening day edition of The Daily Buzz, it's Eugene Hernandez from the Film Society of Lincoln Center. We're here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main, continuing our program. I was fortunate enough, even though the festival officially starts today, I've been able to see some films in advance of the festival to prepare for this show, and one of the ones I've been able to watch is directed by the man sitting across from me. The film is called The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Schwartz, and back on The Daily Buzz, he was here a couple of years ago,
that's right,
is the director of the film, Brian Knappenberger.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Congratulations, I should say.
Thank you.
Have your film at Sundance. I'm sure we take it all for granted when we talk about it on a show like this, but I can only imagine what the last few months, maybe year for you has been like. Tell us about it. Probably a mix
of
emotions.
Well, yeah, no, it's been a hectic year. I mean, we made this film just under a year because it was exactly about a year ago, 1 week ago on January 11th, that Aaron took his own life. Mm-hmm. So I started making the film a couple of weeks after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been a pretty fast pace to try to understand, to tell a pretty complicated story about a 26-year-old that had an incredible number of accomplishments.
He's a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you off.
No,
he's a fascinating guy, and I think what I want to ask you to do as we start the conversation, for those who might be listening in and maybe the name Aaron Schwartz is familiar, maybe they've heard it, but maybe they don't realize what he's done or the complexity of his story. Just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of of who this guy is and why he was so important. And we'll talk more about some of his impact in a minute.
Yeah, well, his story is really compelling for a lot of reasons.
His name is Aaron Schwartz.
Aaron Schwartz, yeah. He was really a software prodigy, young programmer that had played a key role in some really early and critical kind of internet protocols like RSS. He also was the technical architect for Creative Commons. And he was a co-founder of the site Reddit, which is one of the biggest social news, the biggest social news website in the world. At age 19, he and his co-founder sold Reddit to Condé Nast. He became a millionaire. Yeah. And I think his story really starts getting interesting around that time. He turns his back on sort of traditional startup culture. You know, he thinks that the change the world slogan that people use often for that startup culture rang hollow to him, and he kind of dug in, dedicated in a really genuine way his skills to social justice, grassroots organizing, and political causes.
Important to note and to emphasize what you just said, because when folks think about sort of dot-com entrepreneurs, they think of a certain type of person. Aaron Schwartz was not that stereotypical type of dot-com entrepreneur. He was an activist.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, he played that game, right? That startup game, which is largely about build to flip, you know, create something, some website, some startup, and sell it to one of the big players, and then kind of repeat this cycle of earning money. He found that hollow. He wanted to, I think, genuinely change the world, and he looked at it in a very kind of analytical way. What are my actions what, you know, and what kind of effect are they really having mm-hmm. in real life. And by doing this, he became this kind of brilliant and very kind of inspired political activist using new tools, using the internet, using this kind of massively networked world that we're in. He was very effective at that. But of course, his story is also becomes about this 2-year legal nightmare that he was involved with, which eventually led to his suicide.
We go into the film knowing that he's killed himself. We go into the film knowing effectively how it ends. We don't know how we're going to get there. What you're bringing to this film is an in-depth look at, and hopefully creating an opportunity for us to have a greater understanding of what was going on in this guy's head.
Yeah.
What he was thinking. We hear in his own voice what he's thinking.
Yeah.
But let me flip to the end for those who are listening in as sort of a teaser for the film. Why did he kill himself?
Well, I
think
that
there's... Here's a guy who was financially successful. He was making an impact as an activist. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's probably lots of answers to that question. Yeah. You know, whenever anybody takes their own life, there's not a simple answer. And I've kind of tried to resist the simple answer. There was a big, really international outcry after his death that pointed a lot of fingers. And I think some of that is real. I mean, you know, I think that he had some. He was a very sensitive kind of guy. I think that the 2-year legal nightmare really took its toll on him. And you mentioned that he was financially successful. Well, the prosecution really drained him of all of his financial resources. The legal battle cost him millions of dollars. He didn't believe he was guilty. He didn't believe he was deserving of a felony. Mm-hmm. So he, for 2 years, decided to fight those charges. You know, in the film, we go through that kind of ramping up of that pressure that keeps increasing on him from the prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of his story is particularly gut-wrenching. And it's also, you know, it's also lays bare the real problems with our justice system, mm-hmm. you know, handing over huge amounts of power to prosecutors, taking it out of the hands of judges, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Giving power of sentencing sometimes to prosecutors and not balancing that out. But I think it's also bigger. It's a story of what we lose when we kind of lose track of civil liberties and how it relates to our new technologies.
One of your previous films, switching gears a little bit, one of your previous films, We Are Legion, the story of the hacktivists, and you also have done work for journalistic organizations.
Yeah.
It's interesting with your work, I see you marrying a journalistic approach with an exploration, I guess is where I'm mm-hmm. trying to go with this, of a particular segment of our world, which is so driven by and dominated by internet brands and internet companies, but you're looking at a specific subset of that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier that when you found out that Aaron had died, you immediately began working on the film. So it leads me to want to know sort of what drives you as a filmmaker, or what's driving you to explore these stories as a filmmaker. Why did you want to pick up a camera immediately and tell his story, or what drives you to tell the kinds of stories that you're exploring in these films?
Well, I think that you're right. I've done lots of work for various organizations, and a lot of my work has involved new technology and the internet and how that relates to our lives. Mm-hmm. Just as a kind of big picture thing, I think that we have a tendency to separate ourselves from the internet and technology, right, as though it's some weird realm over there of geeks and hackers and technical coders, and somehow it's separate from us. But of course, it's not separate from us.
Right.
Every one of us lives in a massively networked world in which every important part of our lives has an online component to it.
Right.
We can't separate ourselves from this anymore. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. this is, I think, we're beginning to learn this, especially with the Snowden revelations and other things. This kind of shocking realization that we've had about our true relationship with our government that we didn't know in terms of spying, that we can't separate ourselves from this anymore. You know, it matters. We have this traditional notion of civil liberties, and yet we've all, in a very short period of time, moved into this massively networked world.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stitch those civil liberties into that world. They need to be through our code, through our laws. They need to be a part of our new technological world.
In the minute and a half we have left, what do you feel is Aaron Schwartz's kind of lasting impact, and yeah. how is he influencing and affecting the discussion today? Certainly this film will be part of that, but what do you hope that impact will be, and what do you sort of see as his impact today?
I think he's one of those first people that was entering into that new world of that where realizing early on that there does need to be a blend between civil liberties and our technology, that our traditional values that have sort of served the Bill of Rights, the freedom of speech, search and seizure, these mm-hmm. kind of things. This is important to bring into this new networked world. I think he understood that really, really well. I think people are starting to understand that. I hope people take that away. But mm-hmm. on a personal level, you know, one of my favorite things he ever said in his blog was that he believed intelligence was not just, it was simply just curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think that deep engagement with the political process is important. I think he mm-hmm. showed us how to do that in new ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that just that kind of rigorous curiosity about these things is something that we need.
The film is The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Schwartz. And the filmmaker is Brian Knappenberger, who's been here with us today, and he's a return guest to the Daily Buzz.
Yep.
Brian, congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
On another terrific film, and welcome back to Sundance.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing the show.
Thank you very much.
As we continue on the Daily Buzz here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, seated across the table here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main, seated across the table from Todd Miller, director of Dinosaur 13, which is one of the, I guess we can call it opening night films of the festival. Sundance doesn't have a single opening night film like it did in the old days. In recent years, they have sort of a number of films that kind of kick off the festival. Todd, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks for having me.
So Dinosaur 13 is one of the films that's opening the festival. That's got to be exciting.
Yeah, it's just a very humbling honor. I think, you know, when I got the call, it was just elation.
Well, tell us about that. For those who are listening in, because so many filmmakers, I mean, sometimes time their production to the deadlines for Sundance. And then you sort of go into this limbo. You've sent your tape or send your online screener off to the programmers, and you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And somewhere around Thanksgiving, either the week before or maybe right around that date, or maybe if you're lucky a couple days earlier, you get that phone call. Tell us about the phone call. I'm so curious.
Yeah, well, we got a phone call from one of the programmers around that time who said he just really loved the film. And, of course, a lot of other people had to weigh in on it. So officially, he couldn't say anything. And then some time went by. And then
when the first call comes, and you're excited.
Yeah,
and
we didn't really know what to think. So and then it was actually our sales rep had shot me an email, and he said, "You're about to get a very interesting phone call." And that was to tell us that, you know, it was going to be screened on opening night. And I was just, you know, floored. So, I mean, as a kid, you know, for me, Sundance was always a big, huge thing.
Yeah.
And I know in the years that, you know, it's my first time coming, but I've heard that it, you know, was kind of a little bit more of a political thing. But, mm-hmm. you know, we were a bunch of no-names. So to have something like this not only, like, restored my faith in the festival, but, again, it was just, you know, kind of a lifetime, you know, dream.
So your guess was that it all was predetermined. The filmmakers that played here was all part of sort of an insular community.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
community.
I guess, you know, that was kind of like rumors going around, you know, in filmmaking circles. But, yeah. But yeah, we didn't really think we had a shot at all. But, you know, to get that phone call was just amazing.
Tell us about the film. The film's called Dinosaur 13. It's a documentary playing here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Tell us a little bit about it.
So the film is about the world's greatest dinosaur find. It actually follows a 10-year story. So we go from the discovery, which happened in 1990, mm-hmm. and then we follow the original discoverers, the four original discoverers of this Tyrannosaurus Rex. Mm-hmm.
This was in South Dakota.
This all took place in South Dakota, what is termed as the Hell Creek Formation in the Badlands of South Dakota, mm-hmm. Where where the majority of Tyrannosaurus rexes are found. There was a seizure that happened with the T-Rex in 1992 from the federal government that led to a custody battle that lasted several years, which led to a criminal prosecution, which became the largest criminal trial in South Dakota's history, mm-hmm. And then led to a bunch of other things down the road.
Which we'll find out more about in the film.
Exactly.
Don't give away too much.
No. You know, I think, you know, we got the term Dinosaur 13 comes from the amount of Tyrannosaurus rexes that had actually been found. So prior to 1990, all of us growing up, there was only 12 T-Rexes that had ever been found prior to 1990. So all of us growing up, we really didn't know exactly what a T-Rex looked like because mm-hmm. of those 12 specimens, less than 40% of the individual specimens collected were that complete. So when Sue was found in 1990, they estimated in the field 80 to 90% complete. So almost doubled. We didn't know how long a tail was. We didn't know, you know, what a real arm looked like. So, you know, when we were kids in museums looking at these things, we had no idea.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I've seen Jurassic Park a bunch of times. I mean, I think I know what a Tyrannosaurus Rex looks like, right? How accurate is our modern portrayal of these dinosaurs in the movies, and what just as a general give the audience a general understanding of maybe what is either accurate or inaccurate about what we think a Tyrannosaurus Rex looks like, or what it's shaped like, or what it does.
Well, I would say, you know, we had a lot of the consultants that were on Jurassic Park are in our film because there's very few paleontologists working today. They're very coveted jobs, particularly in the academic community. You know, I guess they made them bigger, you know, more scarier than what they probably actually were. But then again, there's a lot of creativity that's involved with the science behind mm-hmm. paleontology. So, mm-hmm. Which leads to some controversy in, you know, how dinosaur growth and behavior actually was. So even though the sample size for, let's take Tyrannosaurus Rex, for instance, was only 13, mm-hmm. You know, after 1990. Now we're up to like 40. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's like taking 40 humans, you know, 65 million years from now, whoever's around, if it's us or someone else, it's going to find, mm-hmm. you know, our bones. Mm-hmm. And they're going to look at 13 people and make a determination on the way we behaved and the way that, you know, we, you know, functions as a society. So, you know, there's a lot of creative interpretation.
Right. With that. Well, so what, with that in mind, I mean, what interests you in this topic, or what interested you enough to want to make a movie about it?
Well, I had actually read the book that this film's based on, which is called Rex Appeal.
And tell us the name of the author for those who
know. Yeah, it was Peter Larson, who's the main subject in our film, and it was his memoir, basically, mm-hmm. of this 10-year period in his life. So he also talks in the book a lot about the science behind Tyrannosaurus Rex. He's, for all intents and purposes, the world's foremost expert on T-Rex. Mm-hmm. You know, Hollywood had been knocking down his door for years, and he'd always turned him away. We came with a different approach, and he said yes.
It's interesting to think about how dinosaurs are obviously kids love them. They've been a topic in movies and TV shows forever. I mean, I think of like Land of the Lost when I was a kid. But what do you think that the study of dinosaurs, or the study of T-Rexes in particular, tells us today? Why do we need to study dinosaurs in general, or in particular, why is it so important that we study this particular dinosaur?
The study of paleontology, which is the study of the history of life on the planet, is important for numerous reasons. I think most importantly, to understand where we're going as a society, mm-hmm. We really have to understand the past, you know. The only people that are really qualified to tell us about the history of the planet are paleontologists. And I think that in understanding dinosaurs, how they functioned, you know, they ruled the world for 150 million years, mm-hmm. you know, plus. So, and if we can understand, you know, what the planet was like back then, mm-hmm. How they functioned, what their behaviors was like, what ultimately killed them, then we can understand where we're going as well.
Let's switch gears. Let's talk about your own background. How did you get involved with filmmaking? Why did you want to become a filmmaker?
I just love it, you know? I think it's like everybody says, you know, you're just passionate about it. And
did you do it as a kid, or how did you get started? Or
Yeah, I mean, study film? Yeah, I went to college, you know, for film.
Where'd you go?
I went to Eastern Michigan University, mm-hmm. And then went to the Motion Picture Institute for a year. It was a trade school. Mm-hmm. I loved it because they just gave us cameras and just said, go out and do it. And that's what I was looking for. I didn't want somebody to, you know, tell us how to do it. So we learned, you know, by doing it. Mm-hmm. And then the guys that I worked with on this film, there's three of us, me, my DP, and my music composer. That's it.
Wow.
We have worked together in the commercial and corporate world for mm-hmm. over a decade. So we do a lot of short films for corporations, that type of stuff. And this was something where we really wanted to take a few years off from all that and like do something for ourselves. So this was something that was very important to us because we could put our personal stamp on it.
Audiences look at filmmaking and imagine this production team that's large and deep and maybe for Hollywood movies is very well funded and well resourced. But you're saying that there were three of you that made this movie.
Privately financed. I mean, we come from the world where we're used to being on big, you know, shoots, 50 right. people, you right. know, right. a grip behind a grip. And for us, we just wanted to, you know, take two cameras, a sound package, a light kit, pack up the truck, get out of Brooklyn, and, you know, put some tents in the back of the car and go away for a couple of years. And that's what we did.
Really?
Yeah.
So what are your expectations going into Sundance? You're an opening night film. It's a huge spotlight to place on a movie that's made out of the back of a truck and on a probably edited at home.
On a laptop.
I'm assuming on a laptop.
Yeah, I edited the film myself too, so it was. I've got a workhorse of a laptop.
In the minute we have left, what are your goals for Sundance 2014?
I would just love this people to be educated on the subject matter. I think it's very important, and I would just love it to play in like every museum around the world. I think that'd be really
every cool. museum around the world. So. Anyone listening in right now, if you know someone who works at or curates a museum, send a link to this interview to your friend. And how can people find out more about the movie? Is there a website or a Facebook page?
We do. It's dinosaur13movie.com.
All right. Share it with folks at museums around the country, around the world. The film is called Dinosaur 13, opening night of the Sundance Film Festival 2014. And the director sitting here with me is Todd Miller. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Enjoy. Wrapping up this first edition of the Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, I want to mention and thank a number of our sponsors and supporters, and in particular, Soyombo Vodka, sponsoring the show this year. Thrilled to have them on board, as well as Cloud Electronics, Skull Candy, Sabra Hummus, local here in Park City, All Good Provisions, People Water, and Super Good. And in particular, our friends here at the Chase Sapphire Lounge on Main, where we're hosting today's show. Stay tuned for more on KCPW all week here at the Sundance Film Festival, more at filmlink.com, and on iTunes, nightly at 6 p.m. on KCPW.